Namo Buddha, Namo Dharma, Namo Sangha. Namo Buddha, Namo Dharma, Namo Sangha. Namo Buddha, Namo Dharma, Namo Sangha. It is in this spirit that we gather. We gather in the spirit of our confidence in what is traditionally called the three jewels. But actually, it's just one jewel called Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, but just one. Buddha is the awakened one, because Bodhi means awakening, and Dharma is what awakening pronounces, offers as a gift of compassion to all sentient beings, and the sentient beings are the Sangha. It's the friendship which connects us, and then the noble Sangha are those who have understood the Dharma and have an experience of awakening. So they are an expression of awakening. Yeah, Sangha is simply a prolongation of the Dharma. The Dharma is a prolongation of Bodhi, of awakening, of that. And we gather in this spirit, and maybe you don't know what Namo means. I forgot to tell you. Namo means I pay homage, or I pay respect, or it can also mean I prostrate. It means all these three things. Yeah, and it is the shortest refuge formula that exists in the world. So when I come to a new place and I don't know whether people are familiar with refuge, then I use this one. Very shy, you know, maybe it works for you to inwardly or outwardly follow when we say Namo Buddha, Namo Dharma, Namo Sangha. And since I know that many of you have a strong religious background from your families, from your upbringing, then I just want to remind you that you don't have to leave another religion or tradition in order to practice the Buddhist path. You simply give it a deeper meaning. You give it the meaning of a path going towards liberation and awakening. And you take whatever you can from that learning, from that upbringing, you take it with you as a very helpful tool on your path to liberation. You don't know much about me, but I can tell you, you know, I'm the son of a Protestant pastor. Right? So, in this Protestant family, my mother was also a religious instruction teacher. I had three uncles who were Lutheran priests, and one brother, one of my three brothers, is a Protestant priest and has married a Protestant priest. My God, I'm surrounded by them. And I'm sending them on WhatsApp, I'm sending them little messages. Do you recognize this? And it was not my priest brother who answered, but my manager brother who answered, "This is the Mount of Transfiguration, you know, Mount Tabor, right here next to it." And today I sent them Lake Tiberias, you know, where Jesus is supposed to have taken a little promenade on the water. So I let them guess, because they have been many times here. My parents have been a dozen times here in Israel, and they love the country. But for me, it's the first time. And my brothers have always accompanied them on the various trips, and so they're also very familiar. So just to let you know, refuge is not something sectarian. Refuge is something that opens. It opens us up to new possibilities. New possibilities that we didn't know about, that they existed. Because somehow our perspective of the spiritual path was maybe a little bit more narrow and not so clear. And the Buddhist path goes well along with a path of blessing, of inspiration, you know, like devotion to the divine, yes, but you have to know what is this divine, you know, you have to know what it is. And actually, basically, it's the nature of our mind. It is that where we find that open, dimension, that creative dimension from where all the worlds arise, you know, the creativity of our mind. I've been talking a little bit about that. And now, what is so beautiful about this Buddhist path is that it has a great deal of wisdom. And this wisdom comes from experience. Actually, the Buddhists, they are very much, you can say, a family of researchers. They are researchers, they are explorers of how to find freedom, how to find liberation in different circumstances. So wherever the Buddhist teaching went, they explored how in that country, at that time, under those circumstances, how is it possible to go a path of liberation? How is it possible to be free when all around samsara is business as usual? You know, it's like always creating trouble. So actually, the Dharma usually went to places because there was trouble. Because if the people had been happy, the Dharma wouldn't have been asked for. And it was only on request that the Dharma came. It was never, you know, like a missionary action or something. Maybe you don't know, but it's important to know. A Buddhist monk is not allowed to speak about the Dharma without being invited. We never teach the Dharma without invitation. So the Dharma will not spread by standing up on the marketplace and making a little propaganda speech. No, no, only on personal invitation. So you can be sure that when the Dharma spread through the world, it was on invitation everywhere. Everywhere. People were suffering, were in stress. They wanted something to help them with that stress. And this is what we call then the path to liberation. It has been called Buddhist path. It has been called Buddhism. But actually it's much better to just call it Dharma. Dharma means the path to liberation, or the teaching which liberates, or the realization that liberates. In the Buddhist tradition, we make the difference between the Dharma of words and the Dharma of realization. And you remember, the words are just the finger pointers, the pointers to the moon. The realization is the moon. Yeah, so the Dharma of words, these are all the pointers, the words of the teaching. And to what they point to, that's the moon, which you have to see for yourself. Yeah, you have to look, you have to see, you have to become seeing. So when we become seeing, this is then some of our quest, of our explorer journey has already then given some fruition. And this is these moments of seeing are the moments when we begin to eat the fruits of our gardening. Yes. Dharma practice is very much a gardening practice also, taking good care of the garden of our mind. And this is a nice bridge over also into what we call compassion on the Buddhist way. Compassion in the Buddhist tradition is like gardening. And the fields we are gardening, they are called Buddha fields. And every sentient being's mind is called a Buddha field. So you have a Buddha field, and you take care, you are the gardener, and you come to an experienced gardener, and you ask, how can I take care of my Buddha field? And the experienced gardener will say, oh, look, this is how I have done. And actually, here we have some seeds, we have some karmic seeds, we have some wholesome, some unwholesome seeds. And, you know, this is how you take care. And this is how you purify, you know, you take care of the ripening of the not so harmonious, yeah, seedlings. And here, this is what you wish to grow. And actually, the secret of the gardener is it all grows by itself. So you just have to create the atmosphere in which the qualities, the innate qualities of your earth, they can sprout. You know, it's already there. All the qualities are there. So a good gardener is one who just takes care that the poisonous stuff, let's call it like that, like the mind poisons, you know, that the poisonous stuff is not receiving more attention. You will not water them, okay? And they do what all plants do when they are not watered, they wither. Yeah, they shrink. They can't grow further. So we don't have to take care. They just do it by themselves. These so-called unwholesome states of mind, if they are not encouraged, they are not given more water, more attention, then they dwindle, they wither, they dissolve, you know, and actually much quicker than in the garden, much quicker. Yes, it's like wonderful to see how quickly they dissolve. And the others, they receive more attention. And you remember this morning's practice, huh? I'm going to talk a little bit about what we practiced this morning. You can entitle this meditation this morning, The Unity of Wisdom and Compassion. This is what we were practicing, right? And we will continue like this for this second part of our retreat. What I will usually do, I will do a practice with you so that you have a personal experience. And then in the teaching, I will explain what we have been practicing. It's a nice way to go about. Always first, I try to kind of create that atmosphere in which you can make a personal experience. And then with the teaching, I explain a little bit more so that you can do it at home. So this gardening that I was talking about is that capacity about which I talked at the end of the guided meditation, this capacity to direct your attention, to direct your interest towards what is wholesome. And this is like watering. This is watering those areas of your being. You give them the attention. And the others, we don't have to fight with. No need for fighting. We just don't water them. Okay? We just don't give them attention. When I see anger, hatred is coming up. Fear is coming up. Okay, I see you. You're part of this mind stream. It's very fine. I see you. I accept you. And you are allowed to go the way everything goes. You are allowed to dissolve. My attention flows on to something which is more beneficial. And at the end of that morning meditation, I told you, well, it is very beneficial to return to simplicity. And we simply return to breathing. And then, of course, this breathing then becomes also a very symbolic breathing, which has all the qualities of mind's nature, which we have been developing in the last days. I have developed the explanation. I mean, they were already there, these qualities. So these qualities that we are talking about are these famous five qualities which make up the lotus. Yeah, the lotus that we were talking about, central quality, is the spaciousness. And we give water to our, we are interested in discovering just how much space is there, right? This is the act of compassion. It's an act of compassion to go towards wisdom. We do it because we love ourselves and we love everybody else. So, because we want to be free, we become interested in where we can find freedom. And one of the most important ingredients of freedom is space. To be able to breathe. To be able to have mental formations, movements in mind. And they have the space to be. no control, no fighting, just letting the natural creativity of mind express itself in a very loving atmosphere. So we must say that liberty, liberation, freedom, awakening has to do a lot also with a loving environment. So it's a spacious awareness already coming from compassion. The space that we find is actually also a space that we offer to ourselves. We allow ourselves to go there in spite of our difficulties. Together with the difficulty. Actually, later on, or even, of course, you can't wait, but we will invite the difficulty into the space. We will take it with us. You don't like that? No, you want to leave it behind. It won't work. If you leave it behind, it will knock on the door. And exactly in those moments when you like it least. So best is to invite the difficulty in those moments when you are stable. So you can make it wait a little bit. I can say, not now. Let me prepare first. Let me prepare first by contemplating the basic nature of mind, the spacious nature, the fluidity, the equal taste of all phenomena, you know, this equality, then linking into that vivid, luminous experience of life with that creative dynamic. And then in that, you know, being really rooted in that and breathing with those qualities, then you can maybe open the door and say, before you knock, okay, come in for a short moment, not too long, and then you let it, and then you direct your attention again to something else. But in a small dosage, very small, just so that it is not overwhelming, you allow that which is difficult to come to mind, and then you have to have that capacity to direct your mind again to what is the refuge, you can say. What is the nature of mind? What ought to breathing? You have to be able to let go. So this capacity to invite in what is difficult, and then early enough to direct your mind again to the qualities. This is what we need to learn in meditation. All other meditation, if we want to keep all the difficult stuff outside, that is like saying samsara has to stay out. Yeah, it's too much. It's overwhelming. You know, it will, if you not only knock a little bit on the door, at some point it will take over our meditation, and then we don't know how to deal with it. We are only in those thoughts, in those problem thoughts. And so we better do it in small doses. We prepare the ground and we take it again and again. And actually, it's not much of a personal decision. The mind will do it by itself. It will bring in something painful, and then you know, okay, here it is, welcome. And already with the next out-breath, you can move on. You have seen it. You're not suppressing it. With the in-breath opening into that space, with the out-breath, you leave it go. And you're back into that pause. Oh, we have prepared the ground already. You have become familiar with the pauses. And at the end of the out-breath, it's so easy to make a pause. The in-breath comes by itself. You stay in that pause of not clinging. And then the in-breath comes and maybe a new sensation arises, new vedana, new sensations arise in whatever field of experience. And if you have that capacity to always let go of what was arising before, then we call this the fluidity of mind. This is the second quality, remember? And the lotus, this is the fluidity which allows for the unhindered arising and ceasing of appearances, like in a mirror. So we have the spacious quality of mind, the fluid, unhindered quality of mind, and we have this ungraspable nature. I call it like that. I prefer this term ungraspable to the word empty. Empty sounds so empty. It's not empty, it's full, but it is not graspable. It is empty of a substance. It is not empty, it's full. It's the plenitude, we say in French. I think the word even exists in English. The plenitude, the fullness, the richness of experience. But hey, if we have a look, then this rich experience, it's of course, it's changing all the time. And because it's changing, the moment I try to grasp it, it's already something else. It has already evolved, and it is new, it is fresh, and it's continuing to evolve. So that changing nature of our experience of life, this is the same as saying it is ungraspable, because the moment we would like to hold on to it, it has already changed, it's a little bit different. And so the mind, which is receptive to this ungraspable nature, can see that so well because of that inherent fluidity. So as we go in that space with the fluid movement of experience, then it becomes easy to see the ungraspable nature. They go together. Actually, they're all expressions of the same. Because it's spacious, it's unhindered and fluid, and because of that, it's ungraspable. Yes? And then we go to the next one, the next petal of the lotus. That is the luminosity, right? The luminous nature of mind. Because it's so spacious and fluid and ungraspable, then it becomes so vivid. It becomes so alive, because no clinging, no grasping obstructs that vivid experience of life. So it's like crisp, like for the first time feeling your own breathing. It's like so unique. Yeah, this is because there's no comparison, no clinging to what was before, what needs to be afterwards. We are so much so in the moment with this clarity and luminosity of mind that we feel very much alive. And we feel more alive because we see the ungraspable nature. And it's so wonderful, because if we are grasping, then we are still hanging on to the last moment of experience. We are hanging on to something that was before. That's the nature of grasping. We hang on, we are not free for the new. So to stop ourselves from this grasping movement is actually seeing the ungraspable nature. We don't have to tell ourselves, don't grasp. No, it won't work. No, it's like a child, don't take the chocolate. No, it doesn't work. It's not like that. You have to see that the chocolate is already melting. You see that what you want to hold on to is a conditioned experience. It arises because of various conditions. And the only thing we can do, and this will be the last petal that is missing, is to create the conditions of those experiences that we want to nurture, yeah? That we want to cultivate. The experiences of awakening, of love, of friendship, of whatever. So this is the compassionate, creative side. The last one is the creative one, that which is the active side of compassion. And this morning I started with making it a little bit clear to you that we have this receptive side of compassion. We are so much a resonance, but we are not only resonance. Each one of us here in the room, although now, because I'm the one talking, you're much more on the receptive side, but while you're even now only receptive, you are shaping the reality of what happens in this room. You're shaping your own reality right now. You have taken your place. Even some of you have shifted places since we have started the second part of the week of the retreat. You're shaping the space where you are. No one else can sit. You know, you are actively shaping the situation in response to what you feel. You felt, oh, I would like to sit up more front, I would like to sit next to a wall, I would like to be a little bit out of the immediate contact. You know, you feel your needs, you feel the possibilities of the situation, and you act. And this is the active side, it's the karma side, yeah? It's where we create something. And this is the necessary second part of compassion. And we have talked about this already on the weekend. I think it was one of your questions that made me talk about it. It is this question about feeling so much pain, feeling so much fear, feeling so much stress. And then we talked about feeling quite stuck with all of our sensitivity, that we are so receptive and sensitive. And in order to protect ourselves, we need to close. We feel we only have that possibility to close. Now, the answer to that, the general answer is, we have to find a way for the active side of compassion to manifest itself. So that is where I said, well, even singing a mantra or even making a little wish, may also you be happy. Or even if I can't open my heart to you now, maybe meet in another situation where it is possible, you know, to make these little wishes, to make some movement with the heart on the active side. Yes? I know people, when they watch TV, is that detonations or what is this? Maybe. It is Israel. Welcome in Israel, you want to say? Yes, yes, I'm here. I'm with you. Yes, yes. We continue the teaching underground. Okay? It's no problem. So, well, this just triggered off an association which I like to share with you. When the war in the Ukraine started, I really made many meditations of sitting with them in the subway. Yes? And, you know, like really going there and trying to feel how it would be possible to meditate there, not meditating in a closed way, but meditating maybe with hands joined or with, you know, really aware of it. Of course, this needs a lot of preparation, right? So I was saying that we need this active expression of compassion. And if you are in a situation of fear, you should know that the fear itself is already compassion. You don't need to look for the compassion elsewhere. Fear is a mechanism to protect ourselves. And it's a movement of compassion. It's not so skillful because it narrows our capacities, because we might get stuck in the fear. But fear is something that signals us, hey, take care, okay? So fear is already compassion, only we might use that energy in a more skillful way. We are lacking wisdom there. A fear that makes us get stuck is not so helpful. I give you an old Tibetan example. You know that Tibet has so many, how do you call them, ravines, you know, these steep, cracks, these valleys, yeah, valleys, but it's more than a valley. It's like really going down, and you see the river down there, you know? And canyons. Let's use the word canyons. Yes, and then you have these bridges going over, which are made of wooden panels connected with ropes. And they are swinging awfully. Yes, and you have to, and for many people, it's very much fear. It's fear to go over them. Now, if you want to walk over such a bridge, I've recently crossed one of those bridges in Switzerland. I got the feeling of the swinging and so on. I had my mountain bike with me, my partner also her mountain bike, and we went over this. Yes, and then if the fear makes you rigid, you have less chances to get across the bridge safely. So what is needed is to pay heed, to be watchful, to be careful, to be mindful. That is really needed. And that's an expression of wisdom plus compassion. You see, the fear which blocks us often makes us incapable of acting. It makes us incapable of feeling the next situation. It narrows our look so much that we lose our panoramic vision. But we can feel the need for protection. We can feel the need for a heightened mindfulness. We can feel that and we can follow it. And we can be very careful, like walking through bushes when you think there could be snakes, you know. You have to be very careful. Maybe you use a stick to tap on the floor, or you open, you know, you go very careful. But to be afraid is not so helpful. Careful is very helpful. Yes? So this care is the good side of the need for protection. This is the compassionate care, which when exaggerated becomes a fear. So if you care for your beloved ones, that's very good. Maybe if you have a 12-year-old daughter, you don't want her to be out at night and coming home. Nobody knows when. She's only 12 years old. Yes? Maybe you want her to be home at 10 o'clock or something, or 12, or whatever your agreement is. You care for her. But if you are fearful all the time, it won't help. It won't help the situation. It simply makes the mother angry against the daughter, and it makes stress, and so on. So this is where the wisdom comes in. Wisdom has such a great effect of relaxing us, because wisdom in the Buddhist tradition means awareness. Avidya, lack of awareness, is translated as ignorance. Actually, it means that we don't see. We don't see clearly. We think, we believe fear helps, or we believe anger helps, or we believe desire helps us to make us happy. We believe behind every emotion is a belief that this emotion is the best way to handle the situation. And this is a lack of awareness. We don't see really what is going on and what is really needed. So wisdom is actually then an expression of which helps us to be even more compassionate. The wisdom helps us to relax. So to develop wisdom is yet another form of compassion. The more we understand the situation, the more compassionate we can be in that. And the more compassionate we are with ourselves and others, the more we want to understand. So the wisdom we talk about in the Buddhist tradition is actually the result of compassion. The whole story with this Buddhist path of liberation and awakening started with the compassionate wish to find an end to suffering. That's the whole story. the whole motivation to understand, to develop a deeper understanding of life, is because of wanting to find true happiness, which is the most loving and compassionate wish you can have. So if you can see that, how wisdom arises due to love and compassion, and how that wisdom then helps to have much more compassionate means at your disposal, much, you know, then you can only talk about compassionate wisdom and wise compassion. You know, they become one. And on the subtle level of experience, then the lucidity of mind, which is also this receptive side, this interbeing, as I said, or as Thich Nhat Hanh said, this this interwoven experience of ourselves, woven into all the world around us. This is what allows us to understand. It is thanks to being connected that we understand. It is thanks to feeling ourselves and others that we understand ourselves and others. It is thanks to opening up to the world and being able to feel it that we can understand it. And then as there is a natural expression of that wisdom, actually this movement towards the world to bring our understanding into the world is compassion. Simple example. Let's take a father this time, not a mother. A father, oh my God, yesterday was such a nice situation. I saw a father going with his daughter into the water in Lake Tiberias, right? And he was taking care of her. She was very small, and he was taking care. And every movement where she was in danger to maybe go underwater, he held her. And these movements, these are so spontaneous, they're inbuilt in us. We definitely want to immediately protect someone else from suffering. And it is the wisdom that sees this might be dangerous. It is the wisdom which knows that head underwater is not so good. Yeah, this is wise, it is life experience. So it is the wisdom which is the knowing aspect and which is very receptive, which then automatically leads to the action of helping someone not to fall, not to drown, learning to swim, and so on. They always go together. There is no compassionate action without wisdom. If the wisdom is lacking, it's maybe not so wise, then it's maybe just not helping the other person. It's like a person is already drunk and asks you for another bottle of rum, and you offer that bottle of rum. That's not really compassion, you know, might kill the person. Yeah? So this is the kind of lacking wisdom. It sounds or feels maybe compassionate, but it's not true compassion. The compassion we talk about is always wise. And the wisdom we talk about is always compassionate. You cannot separate the two. So this is what we were meditating today. And we were meditating it on a subtle level. Breathing in, breathing out. Tuning into those qualities of the mind. And this is something I would offer you to take home, that you actually, by little reminders, that you use sati, this capacity to remind yourself of the essential, that you use that capacity to remind you of discovering the openness of the experience, discover the fluidity, discover the ungraspable nature, the equality. Discover the uniqueness, this luminosity of wow, freshness of the experience now. And discover how mind is shaping this experience at every moment, the active, creative side. Because sati is the creativity. Okay? You have to understand that this mindfulness, this is an activity of the mind. This is the compassionate activity of mind directing us back to what is most wholesome again and again and again. Sati is an expression of compassion. You are familiar with the word sati? This is what is translated as mindfulness. Usually, we translate it more properly as reminding ourselves of that which is most wholesome. And what is most wholesome, you decide. Yeah? Sati always goes where your interest goes. So if your interest wants to simply follow the breath, sati reminds you of breathing. If your interest goes to trying to find where is that compassionate quality in my being, then sati guides you towards finding that compassionate aspect of interbeing. Sati reminds you to always go back to that. If you wish with your sati to explore impermanence, change, and the ungraspable nature, then sati will guide you there. Each time sati, this mindfulness, is the expression of an interest, and this interest is the expression of your compassion, a wise compassion that knows which plants in the garden you want to water now. Yeah? And when we start meditation, any session of meditation, we are a little bit like a gardener going into the garden, feeling the garden, having a look around, and looks what needs to be done. Yeah, where do I need to water now? Or maybe do I have to do a little bit of clipping here and there, you know? And like this then, we direct our meditation in such a way that it really fits the needs of the moment. The meditation is not always the same. Actually, I've never had a same meditation. And I tell you, having taught so many people, you give the same instructions to 15 people, to 100 people. They will all follow the instructions, but you will have 15 or 100 different meditations. Because everyone is anyhow adapting the instructions to his own mindset. You can call this ignorance, but you might also call that compassion. Now, which part of this adaptation is wise compassion, and which part of that is following the old habits? This wise compassion will find out. Your own wise compassion will find out just how much you need to adapt the instructions to yourself. Because otherwise there will be a friction between what you try to meditate and how you feel. If you feel tired and this guy in front talks to you about luminous mind, you might feel, this is not quite what I need to practice right now. I might follow a little bit this luminosity, but I will do this relaxing back, maybe lying down. I might try not to fall asleep, but I will connect to luminosity. More like this from the inside of sleep or something. You know, you will find your own ways of adapting that. And the other person in the room will say, yes, luminosity. Straightening up, looking straight with open eyes into the mind. And will think that this is luminosity. Ah, maybe. It's a little bit fabricated luminosity. Okay? So we find out that this is the habitual tendency of wanting, which fabricates something. And the real explorer tries not to manipulate the situation. So we explore and we find that luminosity which is there before we even have started exploring. Okay, that's the idea. We find the openness which is there before we start turning our attention to it. We try to find the fluidity which is there before we create fluidity. No, this is not the way to create it. It's there. It's there. Don't talk so loudly about it because it's shy. Yes, it's like this. Exploring mind is like going very softly into your mind. Because if you might have noticed how difficult it is to breathe in and to breathe out without changing your breath. Just to have the attention with the breathing, in the beginning you have the feeling it always changes the breathing. And then you find out awareness can be in the breathing without changing it. And this is a great discovery. Awareness can be in the minding process. This is the mind. This mind doesn't exist. It's a minding process. It's a process of experiencing. Awareness and experiencing can become one without changing the experience. And this is wonderful. Then you are a real explorer. This is like the top ideal of every scientist, to explore the situation with the minimum of change introduced into the situation. You know, because every scientific experiment has the problem that the experiment itself alters the situation. So, same in meditation. The way we explore is so softly, so light-handed, that there's only a minimum influence. And this is again wise compassion which does that. Wise compassion is not to manipulate the mind. And this is Mahamudra. Mahamudra is the path of working with the mind without manipulation. It is the unity of compassion and wisdom, understanding that they don't need to be created. There's no need to produce wisdom, no need to produce compassion. Just find it. And we will try to find it. We will, in the practice session, I will hopefully be guiding you a little bit in this exploration. Okay. The last minutes, let's spend in silence. We are already breathing. And how about imagining to cross such a bridge? You know, such a bridge across the canyon. Breathe your way through. Walk that bridge of mindfulness. Just be the experience. Spacious. Fluid, always on the move without clinging, very present, finely differentiating, knowing each step, Each breath. And active. Moving forward. Responding to the changing situation. And I'm sure you will all make it, because from this bridge you cannot fall. Every in-breath and every out-breath is a step on the bridge. No hesitation.